Hey, everybody. I want to welcome you to the Free Man Beyond the Wall podcast. This is your host, Mance Rader. This is episode 104. It's going up on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Evoox, YouTube, on my website, freemanbeyondthewall.com, and on libertarianinstitute.org in the blog section. I want to remind you about my new book, The Kids Are Not All Right, a meme-enhanced primer on encroaching Marxism in the West. It is available on Amazon. It is available for paperback, and it is available for Kindle. If you choose a Kindle option, you will be able to download it in just a couple seconds. Today, I am welcoming James Bovard. James is a USA Today columnist. He writes for The Hill. He's written for Playboy. He's the author of 10 books, including Public Policy Hooligan, Lost Rights, The Bush Betrayal, Shakedown, Fair Trade Fraud. He's an investigative journalist. Today, I'm going to talk to James about increases in federal law enforcement's power and force over the past 25 years. We're going to start with Ruby Ridge. We're going to go all the way up to the Bundy Ranch. He's going to detail how federal policing has increased over the last 25 years. He's going to give you some information about incidents that you know of, but probably don't have all the facts. So without any further delay, here's James Bovard. I'm here with journalist James Bovard. How are you doing today, James?
Doing good. Hey, I want to thank you for pushing my stuff on Twitter. I really appreciate that. You've done retweets and other stuff, a lot of my work. That helps a lot. It means, and I notice and I appreciate.
Well, you've written a ton of articles on subjects that are near and dear to my heart. Reading the, I didn't know about the whole O'Reilly showdown.
Oh, and that was fun.
That was just, I'm reading that and I'm like, oh man, is that on YouTube? Can you find that?
I was not able to find it. I asked a couple of folks who are more savvy than I am, who can, you know, dig deeper on the internet, but nobody's found it. So, if somebody finds it, let me know.
Okay. All right. I want to jump in. Originally I had contacted you talking about Waco because this was, this past week was the last, was the anniversary, the 25th anniversary of Day 51. But I meant to talk about Waco, but we'll touch on it. Basically, I know you've written a lot on just how powerful the federal law enforcement has become. So I wanted to go back to Ruby Ridge. Now, can you point to anything before the Ruby Ridge incident that happened that would have been similar or in the same ballpark that caused the escalation that, you know, that I can see happening, you know, 6 months later, you know, not even, you know, 6 months later you have Waco. Is there something before that where you could really see, you know, after Prohibition, that you can see the federal law enforcement really escalating their tactics?
Oh, Lord. Excellent question. I don't have a good answer. COINTELPRO certainly goes in that direction. That was the FBI's operation from 1956 to 1971 to set up all these organizations to undermine leftists, black leaders, anti-war movements, and other groups, doing all kinds of nasty sabotage. Some of the FBI agents were very proud that they'd spurred violence out in San Diego that had some of the black militants killing each other. Most people have forgotten that. There were a lot of individual abuses. If you look at what Reagan did in the 1980s, revving up the drug war again, that was opening like 10 different Pandora's boxes. There were a lot of abuses that expanded from that. And, you know, it's sort of like a arms race of outrages by different federal agencies. And yet the FBI that was, for a brief period in the mid-1970s, maybe under the Carter administration, they were under tighter controls. That started to loosen under Reagan, and then it became wide open afterwards.
So, okay. So Ruby Ridge, I know you've looked at this situation.
Yes. Okay.
Okay.
You was free to denounce me for my articles on that. So
do you see that as a new beginning in the way the feds were going to, I mean, just flat out assaults. You know, we've seen in the last 30 years no-knock warrants and SWAT raids go up 70-fold. And do you see that as some kind of jumping-off point?
Perhaps. I mean, there were a lot of other federal outrages before Ruby Ridge that did not get the press coverage. Or part of the difference with Ruby Ridge was the feds made a huge case of it. And the feds were, you know, lying from the get-go, as the Idaho jury recognized. And you basically had jury nullification for Randy Weaver and Kevin Harris because of that. But the feds, once the standoff occurred, once you had the U.S. Marshals trespassing for the nth time on the Weavers' property and then ambushing them as they came out to find out why the dogs were barking, then shooting the 14-year-old boy in the back, Randy Weaver's son, things went into hyperdrive at that point. Partly because you had the U.S. Marshals fabricating a story that made the FBI think the situation was far more dangerous. So you had the FBI come in and give orders to their snipers to shoot any adult male who came out of the cabin. And that was completely unconstitutional. Several appeals courts recognized. And after you had the fiasco there, you had a massive cover-up. And eventually, that cover-up unraveled. A huge part of that was you had the Idaho jury, you know, American citizens out there in Idaho, who called BS on the federal government. It was a very testy jury. I've forgotten how long the jury was out in this case. The federal judge was, you know, furious with the FBI and the Justice Department for fabricating evidence and misleading the court. But it was still touch and go whether or not the jury would basically throw out almost all the federal charges against both Harris and Weaver. And they did. And the people in that jury were heroes. It was Idaho, and I don't know that you would have the same caliber of members of a jury here in the Washington D.C. area. Maybe not even New Jersey either. But out west, I mean, folks saw the federal intrusions and they called BS on it. So that was great.
So I know this question has been asked, and everybody has opinions on it. How much did Ruby Ridge and everything that happened there lead to what happened at Mount Carmel outside of Waco?
Good question. I don't have a good answer. I mean, it's interesting. The feds felt like they had gotten away at Ruby Ridge with an FBI agent gunning down a mother holding her baby in the cabin door, and perhaps the feds felt like, well, you know, that the press coverage had, pretty much could have been written by the FBI or the Justice Department for most of the Ruby Ridge stuff. And it was not until after the finale at Waco that the jury came back in Idaho and said, hey, wait a minute. No, this is, you know, not guilty. So I think that was a wake-up call for the FBI. But to see the level of federal arrogance in the entire operation at Waco, these are folks who were confident they'd never be held accountable. And as far as being held legally accountable, they have gotten away with it. However, Ruby Ridge and Waco basically alienated millions of Americans from the federal government. And that's a lasting legacy.
So I know the ATF was worried about converted rifles that Koresh's people had converted rifles to full automatic, and they even sent in, there was an ATF agent that had gone in, and from what I understand, he went shooting with them on a couple of occasions.
Well, on one occasion we know about, take a step back, the ATF said it was concerned about the Branch Davidians converting full semi-auto to full auto, but when the lead ATF agent visited David Koresh's gun dealer in the summer of 1992, the gun dealer said, hey, let's just get him on the phone And Koresh was on the phone, and Koresh invited the ATF agent, you know, at the drop of a hat to come over and investigate. So, you know, the door was opened. And I think if the ATF had come in at any point, knocked on the door with a valid search warrant, they would have been let in. What they weren't let in is when they come in a cattle trailers and 70 agents and start shooting the dogs and then start shooting at the Davidians. After apparently a helicopter was, you know, firing at the Davidians' residence prior to the arrival of the cattle trailers, as I understand it.
Why do you think they didn't just take David when he was out jogging in the morning, or when he was playing a show with his band, or when he was driving around in his mullet mobile?
The code word for the ATF raid that day was Showtime, and the ATF had notified several television stations, local stations, so that they would be alert and ready to film the triumph. They were expecting a huge triumph. The ATF had been involved in a lot of debacles in the prior year, a lot of scandals, racist and others. Sex harassment, I think, was part of it, but certainly the racist elements were part of it. And it was, it was bona fide racist behavior, not like some of the things that pass for it nowadays.
Yeah, I think what most people don't know is that a good portion of the Branch Davidians were actually black.
Yep.
And they don't, that was never, I remember when it was happening, and they were talking about how these people were criminals, yet during the 51-day I'll call it a siege, I saw interviews on TV with Branch Davidians who weren't on, who weren't in the house, who weren't at Mount Carmel. And all I kept thinking to myself was, if they're criminals, why are they being interviewed and not being arrested?
Well, yeah, to take a step back, you were saying I think like the number two guy, Wayne Martin, he was black, and I think he was a Harvard law grad.
Yeah, he was a Harvard lawyer.
Okay. And he was the guy when the ATF did their raid. Wayne Martin was the guy that got on the, dialed 911 and just kind of basically hollering at the police, tell them to stop shooting at us. You know, folks who launch surprise attacks on federal agents usually don't dial 911 to talk to local law enforcement.
Yeah, that most people, when I tell people that, they double take. And even if the cognitive dissonance is deep, they double take, and that really makes them think, because that is a fact. Yeah, they called 911.
Yeah, it's interesting on that point to see what people are. How do I phrase this? To see what people nowadays know about Waco, because there was. There was a mythology that had been created by the feds, even and the feds and their media allies, even before the final FBI assault. It's interesting. I did a piece last week on the Waco anniversary for The Hill, and it got there were lots of folks who I did some tweets on it, and lots of folks did retweets, including you and Ron Paul Institute and the Mises folks, and also Ann Coulter did a retweet. And wow, it's interesting to see all the different responses coming in from that. And I think I would guess most of Ann's followers are rather conservative. and a lot of them were just out, taking the party line of the FBI from 1993. Well, he was a child molester and the children were being abused. I mean, it was like the ghost of Janet Reno was speaking through them.
Yeah, they have a lot of people have the propaganda down pat.
Yeah, and it's interesting to see the reaction when someone basically says, "Well, no, this is actually what happens," and so I end up being accused of being an apologist for a child molester, and it's like, it's a hell of a lot more complex than that.
Well, whenever somebody brings that up, I immediately say, what does the ATF and the FBI have to do with child molestation?
They are forces for the good, so they have to fight all forms of evil.
I mean, crap.
If you look at the coverage in the major East Coast papers, you would think that was the underlying self-evident truth. They didn't get called and that stuff, so it was sad.
Well, the also that they set themselves on fire because Koresh had, you know, said it was a had you know, always said that if anybody came to take them, they would burn themselves. And whenever anybody says that, I always say, okay, show me the sources on that.
Well, and yeah, that, it was interesting. Once the, you know, in 6 years after the fire, you know, we find out thanks to Mike McNulty that the
rest
FBI,
in peace.
Yes, that the FBI used pyrotechnic devices prior to the start of the fire. So it's like, oh, well, doesn't that kind of hurt the narrative?
Yeah. I mean, I've actually talked to people online who could, they were breaking down the molecular structure of the elements in CS gas to say it wasn't, well, that's not flammable. You know, it's not flammable. And I'm like, I'm saying, well, there's a problem here because CS gas has been used. You know, first of all, I tell them it's illegal to use it in warfare, but it's okay to use it domestically. Secondly, whenever it was used before then in a residential dwelling, it caused a fire like 70% of, there was a fire in 70% of the time. I don't know if 70% of the people who've had assaults done on them are doomsday cults that had promised to burn themselves alive.
Well, and the same with the flashbangs. The feds were using flashbangs left and right in the final assault, and those have started fires in a number of no-knock raids. So there were a lot of different ways that the fire could have started. And, you know, a huge issue is here of motivation is once the fire did start, the FBI commander prohibited the fire trucks from going to the scene. And as soon as the fire was over, you had the FBI come in and basically bulldoze, the FBI or other government agencies came in and bulldozed the crime scene. So it's like, well, I guess that settles it.
Let's jump ahead 2 years.
Good.
I'm sure you know where I'm going with this. 2 years exactly, you know, 2 years to the day of day 51 at Waco, the Oklahoma City bombing. What, from your research, was after that happened, FBI, ATF, federal law enforcement, were the gloves taken off even more after that in things that they could do? I mean, they tortured Trinidad to death. Were the gloves taken off?
I don't know. I mean, you had Bill Clinton tried, you know, first of all, the Oklahoma City bombing was it was an atrocity. It was an outrage. It was mass murder to kill the innocent people in that building. And the folks who did it deserve the harshest punishment. Bill Clinton certainly tried to exploit it. He was pushing a so-called anti-terrorism bill, which did make some changes to the law that helped unleash federal law enforcement. But it was encouraging back then to see some of the people who pushed back against that, and the NRA did some very good work, the Gun Owners of America, and the ACLU was very good on some of these issues as well.
Cool. All right, let's leave Oklahoma City and okay. Let's jump ahead 6 years. 9/11. When it comes to federal law enforcement and the powers, things that they could do. Did 9/11 push it over the top?
Oh, that's a rough question. Yeah, well, you know, it's fascinating how there was not a much people were not far more angry about the FBI's failures and the CIA's failures before 9/11. There were so many warning signs of the terrorist people would come here. They were doing very suspicious flight training. You know, there were all kinds of warnings that were given to the FBI. Part of the reason that the FBI couldn't handle that, you know, failed, according to some of the reports, is that they were so backward technology-wise that they couldn't use email, which, you know, I think, you know, I can sympathize. I was in the same situation 20 years before that. But there were so many scripts. But no, certainly after 9/11, Patriot Act, the Patriot Act was a Christmas tree for federal law enforcement. And equally as important was the attitude of, okay, the feds can do almost anything that they want now. And if they go beyond that, then wink, wink, whoops, we didn't hear about it. So very, certainly during the Bush administration, Obama was not quite as bad. Trump, God save us. So,
yeah. Well, you know, you talked about the failures of the CIA and the FBI. Uh-huh. I'm reading today about this, the Waffle House shooter. Have you seen this today?
Yeah, I've heard a little bit. He was apprehended by the Secret Service last year. Is that the story?
He had an AR-15. He had an AR-15. It was taken away from him in a certain situation. I haven't gotten too deep into it, but apparently the Secret Service gave the weapon back to his dad, and his dad gave the weapon back to him. And you know, when you see what all the signs that the local law enforcement and FBI knew about the Parkland shooter, I mean, all these things are coming out. It doesn't seem like they've gotten more competent.
I'm still waiting for that competence to arrive. It's fascinating. There are individual federal agents who are very competent and who have a good attitude towards the Constitution and the law. The agencies as a whole have not done well. It sounds very strange. The Waffle House story. I just saw a little bit about the black gentleman who was very courageous and disarmed the shooter. And then went to church afterwards. I mean, it's like, wow, this is the South. This is the South in a very positive way. So,
I grew up in the Bronx, New York.
Okay.
But I live right outside of Atlanta, Georgia now, and I like it here a lot.
Okay. I hope you didn't lose too much money betting on the next to last Super Bowl.
No. I wanted to ask, the last subject I wanted to touch on is a subject I think a lot of people don't really know all the facts, don't understand what happened, and I know you've written about it. So what happened at the Bundy Ranch? What is the story of the Bundy Ranch?
Well, you had Cliven Bundy, who was had been in a long-term dispute with the Federal Bureau of Land Management. His family had been cattle ranchers out there for generations. My understanding, and don't quote me on this, but my understanding is that they've been using federal land and paying rent for a long time, and then at some point the feds basically decided to hassle them. And there was a big dispute on the rent. They were trying to say there was an endangered species there. According to a recent audit, I think that turned out to be bogus, I think. And then things escalated. And then in 2014, the feds basically staged a confrontation. You had FBI snipers put in around the Bundy Ranch itself. And so the Bundys were afraid that they'd get gunned down like happened at Ruby Ridge. So they put out a call to their supporters. And you have a lot of, pro-Bundy, pro-gun rights folks, and anti-Washington folks who came to the scene. It was very tense for a while. And then the feds backed off and things simmered down, or appeared to simmer down. What the FBI did then is create a bogus film crew. A bogus independent film crew, and this FBI crew kept hounding the Bundy family members and supporters to give them interviews to talk about what happened and their attitude towards the government, stuff like that. And those interviews were later used to prosecute some of the Bundy supporters. And some people, there was a very good piece in The Intercept on this, Trevor Aronson, I think, did it. It's a complete travesty of freedom of the press. It's interesting, the last three or four days, the media's been, screaming bloody murder for Trump's comments, in the Comey memos. And, I don't know if the Comey memos are accurate, but as far as Trump talking about wanting to jail journalists, teach them a lesson. If you look at what the Obama administration did, they had more espionage prosecutions than any president ever. And they were very heavy-handed against freedom of the press. But they were liberal, so it was okay.
Now, the Bundy confrontation actually switched states at some point. What happened there?
Speaking, I can't go off the record for a CANCOM interview, but my impression is that there was another protest up in Oregon, and some of the Bundy folks, two of the sons, I think, joined that solidarity, and some of the other Bundy supporters also went there at a wildlife refuge, I believe, in Oregon. And then the feds came in, there was a confrontation, and then there was a guy who was a spokesman for the protesters who had taken over part of the ranch, part of the that federal land. They were, I guess, going to town for something, and the feds managed to stop, found a way to stop their vehicle, and the guy who was a spokesman stepped out of the vehicle and then was gunned down and killed by police. That was a storyline that came out. We later learned that there was an FBI sniper on the scene who had apparently fired shots into the truck prior to the guy coming out of the truck. So, and then the FBI, there were press reports the FBI agent had lied about that, was being prosecuted. I don't know the latest details on that. And,
Cliven Bundy and his sons, at least one of them, and a couple of other supporters were brought up on trial. And I remember reading something. I don't know if you can tell me whether this is true or not, but I remember hearing that the judge said that phrases like the First Amendment, the Second Amendment, free speech, property rights were not allowed to be submitted in the case. They weren't going to hear arguments about anything like those arguments in that direction. But when it all came down to it, it sounds like this was a Trump. This was so trumped up and so screwed up by the prosecution that this judge, who didn't really look like she was, she didn't look like she was impartial in the beginning, ended up dismissing the case with prejudice.
Yeah, I there were a couple of different trials. I heard something about how in the trial last summer that the judge had put restrictions on references to the Constitution. I don't know, that's vague, so don't trust me on that. And then in the case against the Cliven Bundy, at least one of his sons and a couple of supporters, it was finally went to trial in, I think, started November. The feds were just, there was so much information which came out, which completely destroyed their credibility. There was a lot of information the feds should have given to the defense lawyers under federal law, under federal court practice rules. The prosecutors have a legal obligation to share potentially exculpatory information. There was a boatload of that. The feds failed to do that. There was a report by one of the lead investigators, I think for BLM, said that his impression was that BLM was out to get the Bundys and spark the confrontation and did a lot of other nasty stuff. I did a story for that for USA Today in January, and that's much better informed than my comments tonight. So because I'm cold on the Bundys. So
okay, I'm gonna link up to the archive that I shared on Twitter, that you had shared, that I reshared on Twitter.
Okay,
on my show notes page, because I like the way you write. I like the way your recent speech at Mises was wonderful. I think I Say, what were you going
to
say?
Well, thanks. It was such a nice audience. it was nice to talk to an audience that was very savvy. And, you know, there have been speeches I've given in the past where I just assume, well, you know, folks will enjoy this line. Folks will laugh at that. And then after about the seventh or eighth line that just falls flat, I'm thinking, this is going to be a long 38 minutes. So, but not in Auburn. So good folks at PCs.
Yeah, I think when I shared that video the first time, I referred to, I said that this is a very Hunter S. Thompson-ish kind of take, and him being one of my favorite writers and somebody that I try to channel him sometimes when I'm writing.
That's right.
It was
a great Hellraiser.
It was a very entertaining speech, and I think I'll link up to that one too, because that was a lot of fun. So I'm not going to take up any more of your time. I appreciate the information that you've given, and I'll give you the opportunity right now to plug anything you want to. So
thanks for mentioning my work. I've articles come out in various places. JimBovard.com, easiest place to find them. I've got a blog, Bovard, you know, blog. There are books out there. You might enjoy some of the books. Hopefully get some more damn books out there soon. So, but no, hey, thanks so much for having me on. Thanks for your kind words, and best luck with your forthcoming book.
Oh, I appreciate it. It came out this week, and
congratulations.
Yeah, I was shocked immediately. It seems like there was a lot of people waiting to buy it.
Right.
It went to number one new release in three different categories within 24 hours.
Congratulations. So, that's a great start.
Yeah. Yeah, I was looking forward to it. I'll be on Dave Smith's podcast tomorrow, Part of the Problem, and we'll be discussing the book. So plug that for everyone here.
Yeah, something to keep in mind that, you know, cardinal rule number one, authors are prohibited from being modest. I mean, you got to let people know about the darn book. I mean, it's like, you know, this is an absolute wrong time to hide your candle under a basket. So
yeah, I don't know. Yeah. There's always the old joke about, you know, when you meet a libertarian, the second thing, you know, the first thing is nice to meet you. The second thing out of their mouth is make sure to buy my book.
Oh, that's a riot. I had not heard that before.
Yeah.
Well, damn, I'm embarrassed.
No, man, it's, you know, you've been fighting the good fight for a long time.
Thanks.
And just keep it up, and I will do my best to point people in your direction, because there's a lot of information there that I think people can use.
Hey, thanks so much. I really appreciate it. And thanks for giving me the chance to be on your show. I appreciate that too.
Thanks a lot, James. You have a great evening.
You too.
I want to thank you for tuning into the Free Man Beyond the Wall podcast. I want to thank James Bovard for coming on today. I want to remind you about my book, The Kids Are Not All Right. It's available on Amazon, paperback, Kindle. Check it out. Just search Mance Rader. I'll be coming back at you towards the weekend with another podcast episode. So take care. Have a great week. Bye.